Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, or perhaps more accurately, The Devil Made Us Watch It. Because that's really the only explanation I think we have for...
Yeah, God didn't have a hand in any of this. I don't know why. I mean, people are anxious to get back to movie theaters. I, maybe less than the average movie nut, but more than the average Joe. You know, I'm somewhere in that gray zone. I'm happy to be back, but movies just like this one are fucking dime a dozen on Netflix, you know, or any, you know, like this caliber of horror movie. It's like a limitless ocean as far as the eye can see. So I don't know what draws people back to the theater to see this movie specifically. We go because we're sick in the head. And we chuckle under our breath at much of it. I mean, this movie didn't elicit any screams or any audible gasps or reactions of any kind. So you kind of just sit there in the dark wondering what the people around you are feeling or if they're feeling anything at all. It really makes you wonder.
That it does. That it does. So, if you've been under a rock for the last 8 years, the Conjuring series follows Ed and Lorraine Warren, played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, respectively, who are a married couple who are paranormal experts. I mean, that makes it sound like Ghostbusters.
Is it a spacious rock? Because I would love to join you under it at this point. I would like to forget everything I've been taught or told about
the Warrens,
Ed and Lorraine, yeah, to their friends.
Anyway, they're exorcism experts, demon experts, whatever.
Little of this, little of that. The terminology is very important, and we'll touch on that.
Very important, and also fucking impenetrable.
And I think subject to change at a moment's notice. Not exactly ironclad.
Shot to shot, even. Uh-huh. This is the third, and I would love to say final, but probably not, installment in the Conjuring main series.
Yeah, and Ed and Lorraine featured prominently in one of the Annabelle movies as well, so it really feels like the fourth chapter of their story.
Was it Annabelle Comes Home that they were in? Yeah, okay. Annabelle is this cursed doll that they keep from a case, and then it, you know, yeah. Whatever. We're not redoing Annabelle Comes Home.
No, we reviewed that one. It was a fun episode. Go back and give it a
Black
listen.
The Black Shuck.
It was, yes, correct. And the haunted samurai armor looms large in my memory.
That's right.
Yeah, that was the move. That was the moment. That movie marks the point in my life where my relationship with the Warrens started to sour, and I've never looked back.
Yeah. First Conjuring movie, didn't hate it. Actually,
no,
like kind of it got soft at the end, like James Wan is prone to do, because that one was actually directed by James Wan, not farmed out like subsequent installments and spinoffs.
And you know, as gimmicky as it is, James Wan does have a gift of a kind for the kind of fake outs that run rampant through these movies. You know, I complained about this all the way back in our review of The Nun,
yeah,
where the fake outs have become so formulaic that if the movie is trying to trick you into thinking it's going to come from the right, then you know for a fact it's going to come from the left. You could stake your life savings on it and come out on top every time.
Yeah. Roulette, no less.
Yeah, right.
Pick a particular number and it still hit.
James Wan is better at that, such as it is, than most of his imitators. So that first Conjuring movie does have something going for it. Conjuring 2 is nothing to write home about. And then most of the other movies under this umbrella have been even less of a thing to write home about.
Yeah. It also doesn't help that Patrick Wilson, for all of his fine qualities, he's just in every goddamn James Wan movie.
Yeah.
It seems like.
It turns it all into such a fucking melange.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, now you have to take all the Insidious movies and you just throw them in the stew with
The
Conjuring.
That's right, I keep thinking, like, now, where is this set in the chronology? Is he still being plagued by the Black Bride? Oh no, fuck, that was Insidious 1 and 2. NVM, never mind.
Right, exactly. It's just a fucking mess. Anyway, this particular installment is about this, I don't know, maybe like early to mid-20s guy, kid, whatever, who gets...
Now, we have to be careful about our nomenclature.
I'm gonna fuck it up deliberately, and then we can do the idiotic deep dive into this later on. But he gets essentially possessed and kills somebody, and then the Warrens have to try and prove him innocent after the fact. It's like, well, we've never tried to prove an exorcism after the fact, and proving it to the church versus proving it in a courtroom. Spoiler alert, the guy gets convicted of manslaughter. I only say this because it's irrelevant to the plot of the movie.
And a matter of historical record.
Yes.
So if you were so inclined, you could have spoiled it for yourself.
Because lest we forget,
this movie came out.
Ed and Lorraine Warren, real people.
Mm-hmm.
All of this shit, quote unquote, happened.
Well, and the movies all stress this point, too. All of
To death.
All of their would-be Texas Chainsaw homage intertitle spiels at the beginning of every movie with the yellow text scrolling up the screen always insist, again, Texas Chainsaw style, based on true events. The title drops in all of these movies are pretty much the same. I found the first one way back in 2013.
Yep.
Boy howdy. Incredibly charming was my favorite part of that movie. I was like, damn, that's the right font. That's the right color. I feel like I'm in 1970 something. And then the thrill is gone. The magic, they haven't been able to capture that lightning in a bottle again. It's the stupidest thing to get worked up about, you know, a typographical choice. But you got to get your kicks where you can find them.
Anyway, Matt, let's get a move on. Let's dive in here.
We open with the exorcism of an 8-year-old boy whose name escapes me, and he's got a whole support system, parents, it's not his older brother. His older sister is dating a guy who subsequently gets possessed, and that comprises the bulk of the movie. But here we witness the demon hopping from the 8-year-old to its next host, and the movie spells this out in no uncertain terms. I thought there was going to be a little bit of plausible deniability there. Obviously, these movies are all about magic. It's way too late in the game, too deep into the franchise for this movie to invoke the, like, well, is he possessed or isn't he? Obviously, he's gonna be. But I thought that it would make Ed and Lorraine do a little bit more detective work to figure that out. But the older guy, he's got the kid by the lapel, you know, the milky cataracts on the eyes, and shit is flying all over the place. A priest gets hit with a dinner plate.
It's hilarious. They wait for this. It's like, well, everything's going to move faster now that the thing's been approved, the exorcism. And they do a knockoff fucking exorcist intro, Max von Sydow's entrance.
Ah, yes, Father Marin, I presume.
Except Father Milktoast is more accurate.
Got him. It's heads.
And then they're just like, never mind, we want Ed to do the exorcism because the priest gets hit in the head with a fucking dinner plate.
Immediately, barely gets his foot in the door. It's a head-spinning choice, pun intended. It's such an iconic shot. It's one of the all-time great horror movie shots, the silhouette on the street corner with the light coming down. It's just like the lighting is wrong this time around. The framing is off. You know, it's just this kind of thing. You don't invoke it. You just don't go there. It felt like a desecration. So the priest is down for the count. Arnie, is that his name?
Yeah, Arnie.
The 20-something is shaking the kid, the possessed kid. And again, like in The Exorcist, shouting, take me, take me, take me. Say it half a dozen times.
Meanwhile, Ed's like, don't talk to it. Arnie, cut that out.
And definitely don't say that specifically. That's a big no-no.
But Ed is also on the ground having a massive coronary.
Yeah, because the demon incubused onto his chest and was like poking him in the sternum going, I'll stop your heart, old man. Sounds very silly coming out of a little boy's face. It sounds pretty silly coming out of my face, which I understand you can't see. It's just, I don't know, you got to try harder. Demonic voices are, it's no Mercedes McCambridge, that's for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, as soon as Arnie gets this point across, I'm turning into a Michigander aggressively.
Ope.
Melk. Sorry. As soon as he gets the point across to the demon, it obeys him.
Yeah, well, it takes him up on his offer, I guess you could say, and very clearly possesses him.
All hell unbreaks loose.
Uh-huh. And when we say, let me do justice to the mise-en-scene here. There is brown CGI wind swirling around this dining room. It looks like a Tasmanian devil. You expect like a sepia-tinted farmhand to run through the background like in Wizard of Oz going, "It's a twister, it's a twister." It's completely cartoonish. Yeah, right, exactly. It's way too much, way too fast. It feels like the climax of a different, equally shitty movie.
Are we watching the end of the Vatican tapes?
Yeah, it's like it's like a cinematic human centipede. This movie's face is a different movie's sphincter.
This whole movie is a sphincter.
So, having quantum leaped into its next victim, Demon proceeds to lay low for reasons known only to it, because presumably it could start up the theatrics all over again. But the next time it manifests, it's way more low-key, and it's a day later, 2 days, some time has passed. Patrick Wilson has been to the hospital and woken up after being under for a while.
It's like, something's gonna happen with Arnie!
And what happens with Arnie is that he's living with this drunken lout who has this kind of, he's got a kennel, is like an animal something or other, boarding service of some kind.
Yeah, it's a kennel.
Right.
It's precisely what it is. He's like runs a kennel out of this big two-story house, kennels on the bottom floor, and then presumably wherever he sleeps. And then on the top floor is an apartment of sorts where Arnie and his girlfriend, again, the little boy's sister,
right,
live.
So the landlord is just, his performance belongs in reefer madness. He's like drunk to the point of after school special. He's constantly stumbling and mumbling, and it's not enough for him to be drunk. He's got to get you drunk too. And it's framed, because these movies are getting increasingly churchy as time goes on, it's framed in this like devil water kind of way where he's like cranking up rock and roll music as loud as it'll possibly go. It's a Blondie song, and he's like, "I'm not gonna drink alone," and he's like forcing Arnie to get sloshed with him. And Arnie's not,
but he only gives Arnie like half a beer, because he opens a beer and then pounds it on a surface, and half of it shoots out as foam.
And Arnie's looking sickly. He called off work that day.
After dropping a chainsaw from a tree, lest we forget.
And his girlfriend's worried about him. The landlord turns on the girlfriend, tries to make her dance with him. And Arnie is hallucinating this whole time. He sees them carousing and enjoying themselves, when in actuality the girlfriend is trying to push the guy off of her. And he staggers around, the dogs are barking and they're freaking him out, and he just goes very rapidly into this tailspin where he sees the landlord as this satanic entity scuttling towards him.
Looks
out
like
of the darkness.
Looks like a fucking Salem's Lot vampire.
Yeah.
It's got, that's the one with the yellow eyes, right?
Then the monster at the end of the movie also looks very Nosferatu-y. I think that they both have that quality in common. I don't know why.
Well, I just treated it as the same thing, because it's, you know,
I imagine it is. Yeah.
But anyway, you know, yellow eyes, white face, pointy teeth.
It didn't even occur to me, though, because Arnie is so clearly not in his right mind here, that you just, anything he's presented with, you don't think like, oh, that's the demon. That you think, oh, that's him losing his grip. Anyway.
Yeah, but it's the same thing. It's all a mishmash.
Yeah. And how. So he stabs the guy 22 times. We don't witness this, but we hear about it after the fact. And Ed and Lorraine show up. They got him in the clink, and they're interviewing him. They make him read biblical passages. Passes that test with flying colors. And
puts a couple objects in front, you know, holy objects. Like, well, he's not possessed. He couldn't read the Bible if he was possessed.
Definitely not. Yeah, there's another priest there who's fucking useless, by the way. The bald one. Who's just this timid little
biggest nebbish
church mouse of a man. And he's like, what was he? You're saying he's not possessed? He says it with such incredulity. Like, well, obviously he's possessed. And Patrick Wilson says, no, definitely not. Very somberly. We have definitively ruled out possession, which just, I don't trust myself to remember to bring this up after the break, as long as The Exorcist is on my mind. In The Exorcist, they throw tap water onto Reagan at one point, and Reagan goes, "It burns!" You know, so on and so forth. And that muddies the water, you know, like, well, she's not possessed because she reacted like it was holy water. I told her it was holy water, but it wasn't. So we're going to have a hard time getting this cleared with the powers that be at the church and so on.
And that's just because Pazuzu's a prankster god.
Yeah,
because,
yeah, the devil is a trickster. The devil is the father of lies. And so here, they're so straight-faced about it all. Like, oh, he can't possibly be possessed. It's like, use your fucking imagination a little. The rules are so important in this franchise, and many horror franchises these days. Really grinds my gears. So, moving right along. They have this meeting, the Warrens do, with Arnie's defense attorney, who is very skeptical, understandably, about the defense that they have in mind, which is not guilty by reason of demonic possession. And
they
tried it
in England once the other month, and not successfully. Well, why don't you come over and have dinner with us? You can meet Annabelle. Thankfully, we don't actually have to watch this whole sequence. It cuts directly from her in her office looking skeptical to her at the defendant's table in the courtroom,
yeah,
looking very crestfallen and concerned, yeah, and then entering the plea.
Very shaken, and then she stands up and says, "We plead not guilty by reason of demonic possession." So the Warrens, Ed's still recovering from his heart attack. He's confined to a wheelchair half the time, hobbling around on a cane the rest of the time. They are trying to go back over their files to do with the possessed boy from the beginning. They're grilling his sister. There are flashbacks to do with the kid jumping around on a demonic waterbed, which you may have seen in the trailer. A grisly, kind of grayish, corpsey hand comes out of the waterbed and grabs him. And
yeah,
that's where all the trouble started, apparently.
Well, that's where the waterbed used to be, but, you know, we got a rug over it now because water damaged the floor. Fucking Ed lifts up the rug, and he's like, "Oh, that's a classic case of devil rot you got there. That's not water damage."
I just watched this movie not an hour ago, and I was like, he didn't say devil rot.
He didn't.
Did he? Like, I was
right.
Trying to think, like, is that jargon would not be out of place.
No.
In this movie, God help us. So Lorraine goes down into the cellar underneath where the devil rot has taken hold and finds, more stupid terminology, a witch's totem, which is this Blair Witchy kind of looking thing, animal skull bones bound together with twine in a kind of ornate fashion.
Yeah.
So this is where the jargon and the nomenclature really gets going. She talks to the sister. She says, "Your brother wasn't possessed. He was cursed." Let's not split hairs here. It was a curse that resulted in a possession. Clearly, all the tropes are there. And he was not himself. There was a thing inhabiting him.
Well, and not to mention, we alluded to this earlier, they use the term possession later on down the line.
Yeah,
they basically embrace the fact that, well, you know, the curse induced, like, essentially a temporary possession.
Yeah, they use the terms interchangeably when it suits them, but when it suits them to clarify things.
When it suits them to, well, actually, the audience and the other characters, they gladly push up their glasses frames on their noses.
Well, and it just changes which page of the playbook they have to consult. Like, oh, we can't treat this like a run-of-the-mill possession. We have to treat this like a curse, which entails, you know, it's like, you know, I was a Pokemon nut in the 90s, first gen, same as anybody, fell off gold and silver era. This is how I feel when I, like, I'm learning about a new type that's not meaningfully distinct. Or it'd be like, even like going back to the 90s, it was always stupid, Pokemon was. It's like trying to tell an older sibling who doesn't care about Pokemon the difference between rock and ground. It's like, no, that's not a rock type Pokemon, that's a ground type Pokemon. It's like, okay, it's all sediment. Relax.
Well, and from my perspective, I was more into the cards than I was into the games, and they basically, like, put those two together along with fighting.
Yeah, I mean,
it was even less distinguishable for me.
Right. So the other priest, the Father Marin stand-in, not the Nebbish. The movie is chock-a-block with priests. There's no fewer than three fathers or ex-fathers in this movie. We're about to meet the third one.
Yeah.
I don't know why there are so many, but the one who was the silhouette on the street corner and then got hit with the dinner plate across the noggin emerges from the shadows. It's not clear that he's in the scene. They're all having a powwow, talking about what they're going to do next, and he just kind of emerges into frame and says, "Ah, I've seen something like this before. Do you remember that case involving the Disciples of the Ram?" rings a bell. I don't. It's not the kind of name you forget. So he dispatches Ed and Lorraine to go talk to this other padre or ex-padre.
Father Denethor.
Yes, it's John Noble. And he has kind of an amusing introduction. They go up to his farm. And Ed goes to shake his hand, and after a long, pregnant pause, and you think, it's Denethor, so there's maybe some villainy afoot here, some animosity. Why is he not holding up his half of the handshake? John Noble just says, "I have chicken shit on my hands."
You delivered it too aggressively, Matt. It's literally like...
It's friendlier than that, that's true.
Well, no, that, it's not a matter of friendly, it's just, "I have chicken shit on my hands." It's like, I'm surprised Ed didn't like lean in. "Can you say that again? I didn't catch that."
It's the right delivery for that line, however he delivers it, and then he turns heel and goes inside, and they follow him, and he delivers this long exposition dump about his time researching this group of Satan worshippers called the Disciples of the Ram, and what he learned about them, and what he knows about curses and witches' totems. And you don't want to go mucking around with that sort of thing because these guys mean business, and on and on and on.
Yeah, you've probably heard snatches of this monologue in the trailer. There's like two different sections of it that are in different parts of the trailer that's been played most frequently for this movie. You know, something about a master Satanist is a worthy adversary. And the later line is something to the effect of, "Are you willing to risk everything you have? Because that's what it may very well cost."
Don't know why they didn't put the chicken shit line in theaters. It would have put a lot more asses in seats. Our screening was sparsely attended today, but yeah, well, movie theaters, who knows what's going on there these days. Next, the Warrens go to the town of Danvers because there was they've been putting out feelers to various police departments trying to find other unsolved murders or cold cases involving witches' totems, you know, where that was recovered from the scene of the crime, that artifact.
Basically sending out copies of a picture of their totem. You're like, "Does this look familiar?"
Yeah, putting it on milk cartons and so on.
"Have you seen this totem?"
So they arrive in this town, and a local cop kind of butts heads with them for several scenes, which is pretty thankless. He makes Lorraine prove that she has these psychic gifts by presenting her with three pieces of evidence from the evidence room and asking her which one was involved in so-and-so's murder.
Well, yeah, it's like three knives, which one was the murder weapon? And then, of course, she picks out the right one. And then the next scene, he's driving them to the site of the murder. He's like, "You had a 1 in 3 chance." It's like, what? You could have brought 15 knives out.
Well, I think he is berating himself for that a little bit, although I do wish their game of one-upmanship had not spilled over into this scene, because it's just really aggravating. So first of all, Suspicious Minds, the Elvis song, comes on the radio, and Lorraine has some quip about how that's fitting because he's suspicious in his brain of them, I guess. And I was already annoyed by this because that song came up in Army of the Dead not 2-3 episodes ago. And
Two, yeah.
So then she goes, "I met Elvis once." Once. I know this got your goat.
Oh, yes, it did. And then, of course, the cop's like, "Was that before or after?" And she's like, "Before. And after."
All right, so you met him twice.
Twice. That's not once, Lorraine.
Scene could have ended on his line. Like, was that before or after? If she had just, like, smirked, like, well played, like, the scene could have ended there. That's a serviceable line. So then she has to show him up there, you know, before and after. And then she shows him up again for the umpteenth time when he misses their exit. She's like, "You missed it. The crime scene is back there. You got to turn around." And sure enough, she's right. And so he turns the car around. So in addition to having met Elvis once, twice, she also gets the last word twice. And it's just, we get it. She's right. He's wrong. My God.
Well, these movies like nothing better than dunking on non-believers.
Yeah, I did feel thoroughly dunked on, but it was just like losing a fight to someone yelling louder than you. It did not feel like a... Obviously, it's a movie. I'm not going to get up and heckle. It's not a debate that I stand any chance of winning, but it still feels like I'm losing an argument that's rigged against me in a way that's quite frustrating. So they arrive at the crime scene. They're in the middle of this clearing in the woods, and Lorraine goes into a word that we use all the time on this program, fugue.
A fugue
She goes
state.
Into a fugue state and inhabits the memory, I guess, of this teenage girl who went missing. She stabbed her friend amongst these trees and then took off running. Lorraine now takes off running, panicking, almost lemmings right off a cliffside, and comes to at the last second, turns around. A corpsey hand comes up, like this one we saw come out of the waterbed, grabs her ankle, tries to drag her off the cliff. And Patrick Wilson, who was breaking a serious sweat not 30 seconds earlier, trying to pursue her through the woods, who has been reliant on a cane and or a wheelchair up until now,
fucking sprints the like 20 feet in 3 seconds.
It's the power of love, baby. That's what these movies are all about. He does this, it looks like a dive that belongs in a Fast and the Furious movie. It looks like he should be bailing out of a barrel rolling car. He gets airborne for a while and then slides on his belly and grabs her and then hoists her back up onto the edge of the cliff. And then she says, the body is down there. They drag the lake, find a body, and earn the cop's begrudging respect. Not begrudging respect. He seems like he's basically in awe of them at that point, as we all should be, this movie insists. Periodically throughout all this, we're cutting back to the prison asylum where Arnie is locked up. And none of that is really worth recounting. I'm going to talk about some of it after the break, because some of it is goofy as shit.
Stupid.
Yeah, and worth ragging on. But for the time being, if the Ed and Lorraine stuff sounds extremely monotonous, it kind of is. But to the movie's credit,
it has broken up somewhat.
Yes. So Ed and Lorraine are talking, scheming, and they figure, okay, so there's a human agent behind all of this who has put a curse first on this girl who ran off the cliff after stabbing her friend, and then on this kid. What's the connection? How do we learn more about her? And Lorraine posits that if they get their hands on her body, there might still be some kind of spiritual residue there, kind of portal.
And when we say get their hands on this body, we mean that in the most literal sense possible.
Yeah, they break into the morgue and go monkeying around with corpses, like checking on toe tags. And it just, I'm going to harp on about this after the break. It does not feel like a very godly episode in either of their lives.
Nope.
It feels more than faintly sacrilegious. And it angers me for other reasons, which I imagine I'll get into. So they find her corpse, and Lorraine holds its hand, communes with it. At first, there's nothing. Then there's a whole lot of stuff. She is in a dark room. There's witchy artifacts on a table, pentagram, probably goblets, burning black candles. And she realizes that she's looking through the eyes of the sorceress who's responsible for all
the
of this
master
mayhem.
Satanist.
And the master Satanist is in the process of trying to make Arnie commit suicide. The nebbish church mouse, useless priest character has given him a little vial of holy water, despite the fact that he's in a padded cell. Maybe if it was a plastic bottle, like a bottle of mouthwash that
right.
you'd like take traveling, that would have been one thing. It is apparently a glass vial because the kid, he's possessed again, call it what it is, call a spade, shatters it and tries to cut his wrist with it, begins to, and then Lorraine psychically intervenes and sabotages it.
basically just by shouting at the Satanist.
The blood of Calvary?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, she gets real power of Christ compels you, but like in a more Sunday school kind of way. I feel like invoking the blood of Calvary specifically is like, I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously not a man of the cloth, but it sounds like something that you invoke when you're like going on a homophobic tirade. It just sounded churchy in a bad way to my ears. But then again, many things do, and your mileage may vary in that department, as in all departments. So it's a two-way street, apparently. The witch locks eyes with Lorraine now and extends her satanic influence into the morgue. I thought that she was just going to body jack Lorraine, because that's the epiphany that Lorraine seems to be having. Like, oh no, it goes both ways or something like that. She says something to that effect out loud.
Instead, she uses Lorraine, I guess, as some kind of satanic transmitter.
trampoline. Just a jumping off point. Vaults invisibly. It's not as silly as I'm making it sound yet.
It's not like Dr. Sleep.
Vaults into the body of a dead Samoan. Just an enormous corpse. Which gets off of its slab and charges like a linebacker at Patrick Wilson. And then Lorraine wakes up, thereby breaking the connection.
Well, yeah, Patrick Wilson, again, he like suddenly sprinting again and almost does another dive and like pulls Lorraine's hand away from the girl's corpse, thus breaking the connection. And then the fucking Samoan just flops. Corpse smashes its head against the autopsy table that the girl's body is sitting on, and just thud to the ground.
Yeah, the whole set piece is just
silly as all goddamn
and just a
hell.
Moral outrage. Just morally grotesque.
Oh shit.
So this character that they have this sidekick, this like Jimmy Olsen character who I don't remember from any of the other movies.
Yeah,
he's the one who sends them to Danvers earlier to look into the missing girl. And he seems to do all of their actual legwork for them, at least all of their actual detective work.
Yeah,
He comes to them with a new break in the case and says, what? I forget. Something important.
You got me, man.
All I know is that they're having another strategy sesh and he brings some bombshell development, and then Patrick Wilson has a stroke or like an arrhythmia of some kind. He turns into a remix of himself. He like the same line loops three times.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
He turns into Jimmy three times and then collapses, then gets up and is getting the same.
Now
kind
he's
of,
in a fugue.
Yeah, well, he's hallucinating kind of like Arnie was right before he snapped. The dead Samoan comes back quite entertainingly because it's one of those classic Conjuring shots where you hear a creak. Patrick Wilson, it's always Patrick Wilson, turns around and sees...
Every James Wan movie is Patrick Wilson has stuff behind him.
He sees a door slowly swing shut, and I figured, okay, it's going to be the Satanist lady, or it's going to be the, you know, Nosferatu demon that we glimpsed before. Instead, it's the fucking dead Samoan again, concealed behind this door, more of the linebacker charging, and... Then he starts getting all Westboro Baptist Church, blood of this, blood of that, and he grabs a knife and he's going to defend himself, and Jimmy Olsen comes and stays his hand mercifully.
Because he was about to stab his wife.
Yeah, exactly.
The Master Satanist, incidentally, does make an appearance in this scene, says some spooky shit to Ed, and then dissolves into black smoke.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what she says. It doesn't really matter.
No, it truly doesn't. So then they figure, okay, according to the rule book, there must be a witch's totem on our property somewhere. And then they find it. There's one scene earlier on, throwaway scene, where they get flowers from a family that they helped. This is apparently a common enough occurrence for them that getting vases of flowers delivered pseudo-anonymously doesn't raise any eyebrows.
You
because
see,
they've
I
got a new pot on the table.
I completely forgot about a scene where they received these flowers. I just assumed that when the flowers turned up as a plot point, it's like... Oh, that was not prepared for at all, because
it just couldn't have been.
It
wasn't prepared for elegantly.
Right.
So they smash open this vase. The flowers are all dead and wilted. And
not just wilted, but like ashen.
Right.
Patrick Wilson literally like takes one out and grinds it up in his hand. It's just ash.
And then when the vase shatters on the floor, what do you know? There's a witch's totem.
It's a fucking narrow neck vase. The Satanist had to have assembled the totem like a ship in a bottle.
Or just used magic, which she is very proficient with, because that's what we're dealing with here. It's like, it's after a certain point, you do get into Wingardium Leviosa territory. It just stops being scary on that basis.
Yeah, I guess just that she made the totem and then teleported it inside the vase.
Yeah, or shrank it down and then enlarged it again. Fucking the giant spiders in Chamber of Secrets were scarier than anything in any of these movies. Again, your mileage may vary. So they are staring at this cork board. They got pins plunged into it at various points. You know, why was this victim so far away in all the various curses? And then they go back through the files, figure out that, well, actually, she found the totem much closer to home. The witch is in this neighborhood. That's a big epiphany on their part. I kind of figured that went without saying. They figure out, based on some stuff that Lorraine saw and overheard when she was in the body of the witch, that the domicile, the satanic dwelling, must be at the intersection of a river and a train track. And so then that
mother of
down.
God. By this point, though, Lorraine,
yes,
has gone to Father Denethor's farm to get some Aramaic translated.
I forgot that was the purported reason for her going there.
Yeah, some book that Jimmy Olsen fished out of the Padres collection and was reading. It's like, my Latin's a little rusty, but I read this. And it's like, yeah, well, this part's in Aramaic, so we're boned, basically. So Lorraine has run off to do this while they're chasing down the clues for location. And yeah, it's like, oh, no. And so my initial thought is, oh, the priest has been dead this whole time. It was just the Satanist projecting his image or something.
So I would have gone there immediately if it had just been Lorraine that had met with him earlier, because she's the one that has the sixth sense. But Patrick Wilson being there and the whole thing being presented in such a matter-of-fact way made me think that he's very much alive. He's just definitely in on it. Turns out we were both wrong.
Right.
I mean, he's complicit in it to a degree. So it's his daughter is the witch. It is definitely set up where you think that Lorraine is going into the mouth of the wolf, you know.
Yeah, like he's gonna
It's like when Clarice shows up at Buffalo Bill's house and doesn't realize that he's the killer.
She a great big fat person.
She a great big fat person.
You don't know what pain is.
Love that character. So that's not the case, actually. I was kicking myself like, man, he's Denethor. Why didn't I see this heel turn coming? Turns out I wasn't supposed to. So it is his daughter, and he did withhold some information from them because he was trying to protect her. He, in the course of his studying the cult of the lamb, the disciples of the ram. I said earlier, it's not the kind of name you forget. Apparently it is. In the course of his studies, he accidentally indoctrinated his daughter.
Yeah, basically
to the dark arts.
She fell to the dark side. Interested and then got possessed, but not really, but kind of, I don't know.
She played Dungeons and Dragons.
Too much.
Or Maces and Monsters.
Or the sacrilege. So, yeah, so he's had this secret daughter that he hid away from the world all this time, and then she turned into a Satanist, and he's ashamed, but also still loves his daughter. But now he's like, this has gone too far. I will help you destroy the altar, because that is the playbook. You know, when it's a witch's totem, and it's a curse that may or may not result in a possession. The only way to break the curse is if you destroy the table, the altar, whatever the fuck.
Where the curse done did happen. That's what it says when you translate the Aramaic. That's just
right.
dog Latin, I guess, or dog Aramaic.
Yeah, and it requires a murder and a suicide, and apparently more than one set, because there's multiple murder suicides in this movie.
Well, and crucially, it's three victims. It has to be a child, a lover, and a man of God, I think.
Right.
So
Patrick Wilson in this construct is the man of God, incidentally.
So the child one, well, okay, well, so that's the girl, but then why did...
It's all a fucking mess. I don't give a shit. We're not parsing this.
Well, okay, you can wait until after the break if we're going to do
it. If
whatever.
At all.
Yeah.
Anyway, if the witch, Satanist, whatever, I'm losing my patience, cannot complete the ritual, if her altar is destroyed before it's complete, then the demon will want a soul and it'll just have to take hers. So these are the stakes for the witch. That's why she's not going to give up.
So Denethor is like, oh, by the way, my home is connected to a series of intricate occult tunnels under the earth.
Let's go there now.
He pulls aside a bookshelf, I think,
yeah,
and says, have at it, Vera Farmiga, sends her on her merry way. And
because
then...
I think they hear the daughter upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go now.
Daughter comes into the basement or sub-basement or whatever it is where they've been talking, and Denethor's monologuing about how, oh, I failed as a father, I failed as a priest, I just hope I don't fail.
she teleports.
Oh, three strikes, you're out, buddy.
Teleports behind him and slits his throat, and his tongue darts out like he's Jabba the Hutt.
strangled by slave labor. Only thing the scene is missing is Salacious Crumb jabbering away on the ceiling. So, yeah, he dies without much dignity.
Without any dignity.
Well, you don't stab John Noble in the neck when he's monologuing. You
you let him finish. God damn it.
So, Lorraine is running around this warren of tunnels looking for the altar.
Warren.
Ah, very good. And... Patrick Wilson shows up having crucially forgotten, not for the first time, to bring his heart meds with him. We get a shot of his pill bottle lying abandoned on the table when he goes running out into the night. So he gets a sledgehammer, breaks open a storm door somewhere on Denethor's property that has a padlock on it, and then he descends into the tunnels. There's a bunch of spook house stuff going on down here. Lorraine sees a doppelganger of herself. Ed sees Lorraine. Gotcha. Turns out it's the witch.
This is also in the trailer. There's somebody rushing toward the camera and then pass through a shadowy patch. Classic fucking Conjuring trick.
Yeah, that wipe is everywhere in these movies.
And then, you know, on the other side of the shadowy patch, it's the Satanist who blows, like, I don't know, some Indiana Jones-ass magic powder.
Yeah.
Directly into his face. And I guess this facilitates a possession, or is it a curse? Who knows?
Who cares? Indeed. So he's got the sledgehammer, and now he goes all Jack Torrance on his wife. Less here's Johnny, more here's John Henry, I guess.
Very good.
Thank you. And he pursues her through the tunnels for a long time. This is
a long goddamn time.
And it's prolonged by the intercutting with this disco light show exorcism happening back at the sanitarium, where the useless priest is stammering, reading very, very trepidatiously from the Bible at first, and then he gets his mojo a little bit, although you can barely hear him over all of the fucking pyrotechnics.
More brown wind, you know.
Yeah, exactly. More
all the windows
devil.
Shatter, etc. Arnie, as this is building up, is like floating in the air. He's not in crucifixion position. He's just straight up, but he's basically going to slit his throat with a piece of broken glass.
So we get mirrored scenes here because the girlfriend goes to Arnie and is like, don't do it, I love you. And this is juxtaposed with, say it with me now, the power of love vanquishing the darkness, with Lorraine making her husband snap out of it by causing him to remember their first date.
Which has been related to us already.
Yes.
In a scene earlier on that was completely unnecessary. She's like talking to Father Not Marin. Did I Did I ever tell you about how we met? I'm sure you did, because you've known this guy for how long? I'm sure he's heard this story, but for the purposes of this, no, I don't think you ever told me.
Father Milktoast, yeah, just sits there and soaks up the exposition like a dutiful tertiary character.
And so we see all of these clips again, all of this bright orange variant of sepia-toned 50s nostalgia.
Yeah, Americana, Pleasantville kind of imagery. And then
kissing in a gazebo, all this bullshit.
Yeah, when their first date got rained out. So then, I almost called him Patrick Henry, combining Patrick Wilson with John Henry, I think.
Right. Give me liberty or give me possession.
He uses his sledgehammer for good, not for evil, and smashes the arcane table. And then the witch gets got, the Nosferatu entity comes for her, claims her soul.
Well, yeah, it shows up and then it like turns into a doppelganger of her.
But with like Nosferatu-y ears and
I think it's like it's eyes and teeth. Other than, and she looks pastier than usual. Other than that, it's just her.
Yeah, but, I mean, she looks very Max Schreck, so I might have just filled in the blanks on that one. It is a
I mean, she is a corpsey looking actress, to be fair. But yeah, it just makes her bend unnaturally and then just kind of breaks her and she's toast.
Yeah, and Patrick Wilson grimaces like he just watched a squirrel get obliterated by a semi. It's like the kind of thing where you'd go like, ugh, but not, I don't know. It's not like watching a person get their soul ripped out of him. She had it coming. His face just smacks of an actor who didn't know exactly what they were supposed to be looking at. You know, right. what the golf ball or the, what, you know, what, however they do motion capture these days, what it was supposed to represent. So, cue the epilogue. Arnie is found guilty of manslaughter, not murder. We don't get into the particulars of how the jury arrived at that verdict. And he gets let out in 5 years, married his girlfriend. They're still married to this day. How wholesome. Patrick Wilson builds a gazebo for his wife on their lawn. And that's basically it.
Yeah.
They add the witch's goblet to their collection.
Yeah, there's a scene at the end of every one of these fucking Ed and Lorraine Warren movies, be it one of the Conjurings or Annabelle Comes Home, where whatever they decide is, why wouldn't it be one of the totems?
Right.
That's clearly more, but no, it's this goblet from the fucking table that barely makes an appearance in the movie. Anyway,
well, it's the goblet,
all of these fucking movies.
That's the what that she's doing, the bubbling brew.
I know. I mean, in theory, it's the most significant object, but we barely ever see it. So
now,
it
know,
feels
filmically,
random.
You're right. It's, yeah, it wasn't given the same visual priority.
Right. But yeah, again, at the end of all these fucking movies, there's always this scene where Patrick Wilson is very gingerly setting another fucking object on another space on their fucking demon shelf.
And, you know, if you're a particular kind of...
It's like we're watching a series of episodes of, I don't know, Goosebumps or something.
It is extremely Goosebumpsy. More on that after the break, believe it or not. And you run the risk with scenes like this, because it's not like he gives the goblet a place of prominence. He just picks an empty part of an otherwise very cluttered shelf.
Yeah, the
and
only
sets
thing
it down there.
There's only one thing that has room for prominence in that room. Maybe two things: Annabelle, and then maybe the portrait of the nun,
who both got their own movies already, which is why they have the seats of honor at the table.
Right.
Because hey, remember this? Elbow in the ribs. But yeah, him putting the goblet down where he does just makes this movie feel like a total fucking footnote, as if it didn't already.
Right.
So I understand if you're a particular kind of horror hound and franchise devotee, you might go apeshit for scenes like this, because you would point out different things and go like, oh, remember that? Remember this? Remember? And if that's the kind of moviegoer you are, then Annabelle Comes Home is definitely your favorite one, because it's the most bang for your buck. It's the kind of like horror junkie who like knows the names of every Cenobite in Hellraiser.
Ugh.
You know, like, right. I like Hellraiser more than you do, I think, but I only know Pinhead by name.
That's because you're a sane person.
Anyway, different floats for different boats, but it's not for me. It's not for us. More after the break.
Whatever is going on, whatever happened that day, that was not Arnie. It's a witch's totem. We think your family was cursed. And that connection's still broken.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
A master Satanist is not an adversary to be taken lightly.
She's doing it again. She's reaching out to the darkness.
Lorraine, you need to come back. Is saving him worth everything you have? Because that's what it may very well cost.
And we're back. I am so impossibly goddamn tired of the jargon. I cannot fucking tolerate it any longer. This shit where, oh no, it weren't possessed, they were cursed. Obviously, we already talked about this, but I just have to emphasize how fucking inane that is. Who gives a shit? I mean, they don't even give a shit because they can't keep the fucking terminology straight themselves.
It always reminds me of that scene in Wolf of Wall Street where Matthew McConaughey goes, "Hey, it's a wazzy, it's a woozy, it's fairy dust." It's like, he's supposed to be the expert and he doesn't care, Fugazi, Fugazi, whatever. And that, right. that's these movies reek of that same indifference, only on a metatextual level, because the characters earnestly believe what they're saying, but still the pungent aroma of snake oil is just all over this thing.
Yeah. By contrast, in our previous episode about A Quiet Place Part 2, at one point, I can't remember if it's Cillian Murphy asking Emily Blunt this question or if it's somebody else. I think it's him, though. And I'm like, so how does it work? Is it creating some kind of feedback or something? And
oh, yeah.
She just says, I don't know, it just works. When that line came up, I was like, yeah, okay.
Good on you.
I'm cool with that.
I could have done with more of that attitude as it pertains to why they couldn't get the Bobby Darin song Down in the Valley. You know,
sure.
Sometimes it's some mysteries are too boring to be worth solving.
Right. So if it's something like that and the characters manifestly don't care, cool. All about it. But yeah, like you say, when the characters, again, fucking adjust their nerd glasses and well, actually, everyone about like, well, it's this, not this. And that means this. And therefore, we have to do this. And meanwhile, the fucking screenwriter is clearly sitting in whatever room he does his writing and looks over at whoever else is there. These fucking assholes. They're going to watch this crap. It's hilarious. Fuck you. Kiss my entire ass.
Well, and the problem with these movies getting progressively churchier with each installment is not just that it's, I mean, after a certain point, it does get a little God's not dead with the skeptics being brought in just to get shown up, you know, and that isn't for me, clearly. But it also takes on slightly more sinister undertones with this movie in particular, because it's about a human ne'er-do-well who's responsible for all of this. You know, satanic cabals operating in our world who mean us harm. It just feels like the next Conjuring movie is going to be...
It's actually not Satanists, they're Zionists.
Well, there's that. I was going slightly more mundane or benign, but still bothersome to me. I just kind of figured that the next Conjuring movie was going to be about Ed and Lorraine's crusade against R.L. Stein. Or the fucking or Harry Potter, maybe, or Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, or any of those banned books,
right?
You know, from days of yore, just trying to get Goosebumps on the banned books list, or whatever the hell, or burning D&D players' handbooks. That's why I brought up fucking D&D earlier. These bullshit satanic panics that crop up every 20 or 30 years. It's just claptrap, you know? It's just the more these movies get lost in their own lore, and the more they've gotten too impressed by the Warrens. The Warrens aren't a loving couple anymore. I mean, they are. It's basically all they are is a couple who loves each other almost as much as they love Jesus.
Right.
But they're not a relatable, down-to-earth pair of Ghostbusters anymore the way that I think they were in 2013.
Yeah, I seem to recall they had more of that energy. Yeah, now they're just... It's like the Pope came to town.
Right, yeah, and his little Pope-mobile, and that's all she wrote. Well, because, like, in that first movie, they felt like they were figuring some of it out on the fly. They were underdogs. You know, like, Indiana Jones is a know-it-all up to a point, but there are things where he has to think fast, think on his feet, improvise. You need some of that spontaneity in a movie like this, in a movie about whether it's archaeology or demonology or any of these kind of esoteric subjects. You need a little bit of curiosity. You can't have all the answers all the time, or it is just unbearably preachy.
Yeah, these movies have gotten really just incredibly churchy. And also, frankly, the subtitle of this movie sold us a fucking bill of goods. The devil did not make him do it. A demon made him do it.
And that demon did it because a woman made him do it.
Yeah. So really...
And maybe the devil made her do it.
But maybe not. That's the food chain. I mean, like, she theoretically worships the devil, but I don't know. Is she taking instructions, or did she do this on her own account? She putting out her own shingle. I mean, like, who the fuck knows?
Well, her MO is so fucking lost in the sauce. It's just like, to the end of the movie, there's no clear answer as to why she singled out these particular people. It's like all conspiracy theories. It's a house of cards. It reminded me of that shitty Netflix true crime doc about Son of Sam from a little while ago, where it was disappointing, actually, because it's by one of the directors who did Cropsey. And it could have been a good documentary if it hadn't been, I'm sure, contractually obligated to be a four-part Netflix series. They're all always four parts long. The Elisa Lam one was also bloated in kind of the same way. It goes down to some of the same bullshit cul-de-sacs and rabbit holes. Anyway, I'm getting off subject here. Point is, this Son of Sam thing and this Elisa Lam thing both commit the cardinal sin of padding themselves by giving conspiracy theorists a seat at the table. In the case of the Son of Sam thing, this conspiracy theorist, voiced by Paul Giamatti, weirdly, in narration, is the main character, the protagonist. And the movie eventually discredits him. The series eventually discredits him, but not until it's heard him out ad nauseum.
You shouldn't have said it was Paul Giamatti. Now I want to watch it. I want to listen to Paul Giamatti voice a conspiracy theorist whose theory is about Son of Sam.
Yeah, and how Son of Sam was involved with a cult of Satan worshippers, wouldn't you know? And a lot of this crap is drawn from the same poisoned well. It's always satanic goings on. Anyway, why did I go off on this tangent? It's perilous, I think, taking this stuff at face value. I just kept thanking my lucky stars the whole way through that Ed and Lorraine were presumably retired by the time the Slender Man stabbing happened. If they'd gotten mixed up in that, it would have been a total fucking debacle trying to exonerate the two would-be murderers because Slender Man actually made them do it. Or some entity pretending to be Slender Man.
I would watch an 8-minute YouTube parody video to that effect. I would watch that several times.
But not a 4-part Netflix special, so don't you go getting any ideas.
Yeah, just put out more, off Ted Sarandos.
Put off more feature-length true crime docs, for the love of God. Just a tight 90, or 2 hours even. Just not, whatever. It's the model that works, apparently, or they wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
Just when they get to the morgue, that's just the fucking worst. I mean, when they're meeting with John Noble earlier and he's talking about all the heinous shit that he witnessed when he was embedded with the children of the goat or whatever the hell, he says, the sacrilege I saw, I shan't speak of it. It's like, it couldn't be that much worse than when they start messing with the toe tags. Pulling back.
And holding a corpse's hand.
Pulling back the sheets. And yeah, getting handsy. It was just gross. And it reminded me more like sleazy true crime. It reminded me of basic cable ghost hunting shows where they'll be called out to this allegedly haunted house, you know, because the tap turned on by itself once or something like that. Basic bumps in the night. And then in order to get the episode out to half an hour or whatever length they need it to be with commercials, they have to dig up some murder from 1972 that happened in an adjacent county, you know, like, oh, could these be connected? It's like, no, don't drag that poor girl who was found in a quarry into this. She's got nothing fucking to do with the runny taps. Like, have a heart, have a conscience. That's where my mind went when they broke into the morgue and started getting up to their mischief in there. It was like, okay, this is beyond the pale a little bit.
Yeah. Speaking of the morgue and the giant dead Samoan, once again, as is always the problem with these movies, and I feel like this was a criticism we also leveled at a relatively recent episode about something else, and maybe when I make this point, you'll remember what I'm trying to remember here. The fucking adversary is too goddamn diffuse. It's, you know...
I made that complaint about Jigsaw, but
okay,
it stands, yeah. Yes. The point stands.
So, are they fighting the demon? Are they fighting the Satanist? Is the demon this fucking Salem's Lot Nosferatu thing, or is it this giant Samoan?
I think the giant Samoan just got mixed up with the wrong crowd. It's just a body in the wrong morgue on the wrong night.
Well, it's just when it reappears in the Warren's house in Ed's hallucination, I'm just like, oh, this has been added to the rogues gallery now.
I guess, yeah. put them in the usual suspects lineup along with the haunted samurai suit and the fucking, I don't know.
The black shuck.
The black shuck, thank you.
And I forgot to mention this during the synopsis, but Patrick Wilson, when the Samoan shows up in the house, when it cuts to him reacting to its appearance, he has this great, like, distasteful frown on his face, like, oh, you're here.
I already made fun of his grimace when the Satanist lady gets her comeuppance at the end of the movie, the roadkill grimace.
Right.
He pulls a lot of kind of stupid faces throughout this movie. I already made fun of the remix moment when he goes down with his mild heart attack or whatever it was. He also... oh, what was the other one that made me titter? It'll come to me, or maybe it won't.
Anyhow, point being, once again, and this movie is not as bad in this respect as Annabelle Comes Home with Annabelle in the samurai armor and the black shuck and this and that, whatever. But still, there's too many antagonists.
Oh, he made a funny noise when the witch blew dust into his nose.
That's
he goes like,
right. Walk on.
That's all. Carry on.
Sure. It's just when your demon can shapeshift into a bajillion different forms, or if in this case you have that and also the fact that the demon is being controlled by a human antagonist on everything else, there's just nothing to latch on to. There's nothing to be scared of,
yeah,
or hang your hat on. It's just, it's all a mess.
Well, and you can get away with that if the villain is set up as a deceiver, like the demon in The Exorcist, where it claims to be the devil but probably isn't. You know, I am the devil, but kindly undo these straps. And again, this muddies the water. I think it might be even the same scene where the priest talks about how the tap water was mistaken for holy water. He says, claiming you're the devil is like claiming you're Napoleon Bonaparte. It's like a classic schizophrenia delusion. Or, you know,
right.
it's something that he's heard a lot in his line of work. He's a psychiatrist in addition to a priest or priest in training or whatever his deal is. So again, a little bit of that healthy skepticism would serve these movies very well, I think. And also, if you're going to have a character that assumes multiple forms or lies about its exact identity, let the lies contribute to an ambiguity that cloaks the movie in an atmosphere and this kind of enigmatic... I don't know, the way that the characters in this movie, the way that the Warrens go about their work, their vocation, it just dispels all ambiguity all the time. So it's impossible. If they had met Pazuzu and it had claimed, "I am the devil," they would have fired back, "No, you're not. You're Pazuzu." You showed up in ancient Syria at such and such a date, and you did this. We've got your whole rap sheet here. We know the score. You can't pull the wool over our eyes. You got to get up pretty early in the morning to fool the Warrens. Just lame as hell.
Yeah, very silly.
You said that the title sold you a bill of goods. The whole premise of the movie is something of a Trojan horse. It teases a courtroom drama, like a legal showdown.
Yes, that too.
A la Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Right.
Which, you know, which would have been a little bit been there, done that, because that movie came out in like 2005, I think.
Yeah.
But then again, enough time has passed. You could take a second pass at that and maybe do something interesting with it. Would have been more interesting than just rehashing all the James Wan tropes that we get in this movie, which are, I said that he does those kind of hijinks better than most of his imitators. The guy who directed this one, Michael Chavez, I think is the name. The fake outs, the monsters in this movie often come from the direction that you think they're going to come from. What the fuck am I trying to say? the movie isn't actually faking you out half of the time. The movie sets it up like they're going to come from the right, and then they do actually come from the right. The worst one was when Lorraine is in the woods at night. Well, it's broad daylight, but she's hallucinating that it's pitch black. And she's looking at this particular tree for a long time. And so you think, okay, a hand is going to grab her shoulder. Maybe something's going to come out from the ground. It's going to come from anywhere but that tree. And then two people with flashlights come out from behind that tree. And there's a very perfunctory, half-hearted jump scare. And it's like, well, what is this jack-in-the-box bullshit? It came from the tree. What are you doing? Is it like a double fake-out? Are we playing 4D chess at this point? Is this Iocane powder? Where are we?
It's all poison.
We're not in the courtroom. That's the main thing. We spend absolutely no time in the courtroom after the lawyer pleads not guilty by reason of blah, blah, blah.
Except for the 30 seconds at the end where...
Yeah, we see him walking into the courthouse in slow-mo.
To hear the verdict read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we didn't get our exorcism courtroom drama, which, again, after 16 years, you could have done that again. That might have been interesting. Yeah, Michael, I tried to ascertain the pronunciation of this man's name, the director. I hopped on YouTube, found a bunch of interviews, and
he is just as diffuse as the fucking monsters in the movies
he
makes.
That's goddamn right. I watched three different videos that he is in. He is being interviewed on like really obscure, shitty podcasts.
We could probably have landed him if
we probably could have landed him.
Roasted his movie as viciously as we have.
Three different videos and three different pronunciations of his name. The first one was Michael Chaves. I'm like, that's got to be like over anglicized.
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't correct them, obviously, because that'd probably make for bad content. But also he did like they weren't briefed. Then the second one was Michael Chavez. The third one was Michael Chavez, and it's spelled like Chaves. There's no Z on the end. It's Chaves. However the fuck this guy's name is pronounced, he's a goddamn hack. He directed
The Curse of La Llorona,
which, in case you're getting mixed up, is the one we did first. Not the foreign language La Llorona from Chile, which was actually good. But the shitty James Wan expanded universe.
Or is it?
Well, whatever.
It was a borderline case, apparently. We hashed this out back when we reviewed it. Talk about this whole project being a fucking melange. It was like a Schrodinger's Conjuring movie. They had this kind of attitude about it where they could take it or leave it, apparently. I can't forget the tortured sentence I read off Wikipedia to justify... You know, it's like they were making it sit at the kids' table on Thanksgiving. It wasn't invited to dine with the big boys. But they have it on standby in case they ever want to incorporate La Llorona into anything. Figure if she was going to make an appearance anywhere, it would probably have been in this movie. Somewhere, shoehorn her into the post-credits sting, maybe.
Right.
Smuggle her in, like, there, Michael.
Drop her veil into the Warren's, like, assortment of artifacts.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, that...
Take you home, introduce you to La Llorona.
To Mrs. Llorona. But yeah, you can listen to that episode, or you can just have me tell you now, that movie is trash, and this movie is marginally better, I guess. It's less insufferably stupid at every turn.
It's a marked improvement, I think. I feel comfortable saying that. There are a few moments where it lapses into Llorona caliber goofiness. There's some real goofball dissolves right before Arnie tries to kill himself with the broken bottle. Mm-hmm. He's like sitting in his cell and he's layered over himself like it's the opening of Apocalypse Now, but with no napalm trees or helicopters or anything interesting to look at. It's just multiple shots of the same cell, and he's kind of,
well, and at first
half,
I couldn't,
like, translucent.
I couldn't tell what they were doing. Like, I thought there was going to be a doppelganger of him either about to hurt him, or it was going to give him, like, the Smeagol Gollum treatment, like, right, trying to talk him into killing himself. And instead, no, it's just, as Matt said, kind of a dissolved montage of his unease.
There were a lot of really weird fades to black in one scene in La Llorona that stands out in my memory. We griped about it ad nauseum, I'm sure, back in the day. A lot of weird, unmotivated ellipses during a moment in the climax where it really was not called for.
Yeah.
It just started. I felt like I was getting drowsy. I think the joke I made at the time was that I was going to, like, wake up on a stretcher somewhere. I thought I was having an episode of some kind. Like, I couldn't keep my eyes open.
You were going into a fugue.
Yeah, precisely. It's bound to happen eventually, all these fucking movies. The other goofball moment, many of them are reserved for Arnie, is when he's he's in the asylum or the prison or whatever the fuck, and another inmate and or patient starts reciting Blondie lyrics to him.
Yeah, it's the lyrics from Call Me.
Yeah. He does, like, a dramatic staged reading.
All
of
these fucking movies think, oh, we can just take popular songs and then, like, slow them down and pitch them down, and then they'll be spooky.
Or just play Tiny Tim.
Yeah, no, they started with Tiny Tim, and now...
That's Insidious, right?
I think so. Okay. I don't fucking remember. It's one of... Patrick Wilson's in it. I don't know.
And in case you've forgotten, in case you haven't, like, done Call Me a Karaoke recently, let me ring some bells for you. Color me your color, baby. Color me your car. Color me your color, darling. I know who you are. He really sinks his teeth into that one. Come up off your color chart. I know where you're coming from. Doesn't even rhyme. And Blondie gets away with it, but this schmuck doesn't.
No. And it's just, this is not spooky. It's fucking funny. This belongs in Scary Movie.
Yeah, impossible to take seriously. Speaking of songs, I could go a good long while without hearing Suspicious Minds again anytime soon. That song came on the radio when they were in the cop car, and I felt like I was caught in a trap.
And could not get out.
Indeed. It's a great song. Yeah, he's the king, yeah, or whatever, but I'm good for a minute.
Fucking blue brain zombies and churchy possession movies.
Right before or right after the weird superimpositions in the padded room, there is a sinister shadow coming along the wall. This is, like, straight out of a Scary Movie.
Yep.
Spoof. There's a shadow going along the wall that looks a little demonic, and then it turns out it belongs to a corpulent security guard.
Yep.
Who's just kind of plodding along and looks meaningfully into the cell. It was just...
just dumb.
Just dumb. Just willfully dumb. Now, I will say that occasionally, and the only reason that I like this movie better than La Llorona, not by, like, a country mile, but by a discernible difference.
A country furlong.
Is because there are some moments that are directed with a certain amount of... It gets stylish every once in a while, and sometimes that's a swing and a miss, and occasionally, I mean, the climaxes are overlong, but some of that intercutting, I found myself thinking, like, some of these cuts are impacting me more successfully than the intercutting that I was griping about in our last episode about Quiet Place Part 2. Maybe it's just because there's so much bullshit happening on screen. You know, you've got the exorcism in the prison, asylum, wherever, where there's all these searchlights strobing and swinging around for some reason. And again, the Tasmanian devil twister. And then that's intercut with Patrick Wilson swinging the sledgehammer and smashing apart wooden support beams and statuary and all of this. There's one shot in particular, I think it's ripped right out of The Shining, actually, so I really shouldn't give it any credit at all, where it's just his feet kind of stomping along and then the head of the hammer scraping along the ground behind him. And I thought, like, okay, that's well composed, maybe because it's lifted from Kubrick, who had some of the best eyes ever. But some of that cutting back and forth, I might have just been in such a stupor at that point that anything would have dazzled me, but I thought that was okay. Conversely, there's a show-off-y shot in the first act. It's when we're introduced to the louse of a landlord that they live with, actually, where the camera is flying through this whole multi-story home, going between the dog cages, and everyone's got business. It'll come to rest on a character for a second, and they'll do something, and then it'll fly around, goes outside, goes in. And I thought, like, come on, guys, this isn't the fucking back entrance to the Copa. Ease up. You don't. There's a shot just like that in the original Conjuring that kind of annoyed me, too. It's when they're moving into the new place, mm-hmm. they being the family. That's the other thing. The original Conjuring, the Warrens were called in. They didn't assume center stage as much as they do in all the subsequent movies, which is
true.
Another missing ingredient. When the family that's afflicted by the haunting, or whatever you want to call it, in the original Conjuring is moving into their house, there's an ostentatious shot like that. I remember it swooping under a couch that two characters are carrying, getting it over the threshold, carrying it across the porch or whatever. And I thought, like, okay, Scorsese, enough is enough. So maybe that's just a hallmark of the franchise. I don't know. What I do know is that there were no moments in La Llorona that made me think the director had any potential at all. This time around, there were more misses than hits, but there was a hit here or there. And so for me, these movies are totally distinct in that respect.
Right. Speaking of misses, I just want to highlight one. It's during the climax where Patrick Wilson is being forced back to his senses by Vera Farmiga and the sepia-toned nonsense, where it turns into 300 and he brings up the sledgehammer and it down on the...
Something out of a Godsmack music video. When the head of the hammer hits the table, it does get very Snydery. You see little witchy objects coming up off the table in super slow-mo.
I stand alone!
Yeah, it turns into this weird heavy metal stunt that...
But only for about 8 seconds, and right. then it goes back to normal. It's just that shot.
Swing and a miss. Well, he hit the table, I guess. So that's what
it was
matters.
A swing and a miss for Michael Chavez, but not for Patrick Wilson,
Cha-cha,
I guess.
Slide. I wish they had just made John Noble in cahoots with the witch. You know, like, I thought that they were husband and wife.
Give us a villain with some charisma.
Right. Well, that's the first time you see her, the first time you get a good look at her, there are a couple compositions later in the movie where she looks slightly more imposing, but the first time you see her when
she looks like a school marm.
Yeah, she looks like this dour, matronly, normal old lady. It's an unbelievable fumble because there's all of this. Vera Farmiga has been getting glimpses of her in various psychic flashes.
And wincing all the time.
From the very first scene on. And you never see her face. And then you do see her face. And she's a school marm, like you said. She looks like she's going to give you a rap across the knuckles. And that'll be the end of it. That's about as bad as it's going to get.
Yeah.
So obviously John Noble could pick up that slack if the screenplay had entrusted that role to him. And I thought... First of all, he leads Vera Farmiga down into the basement, gets out this photo album, and starts to explain, you know, she's my daughter, this is how she had her Anakin fall from grace. As he's regaling her with all of this, he is bathed in the reddest light. It's like he develops photographs in this basement. He's just got a red bulb suffusing both of their faces. They're just awash in it. And you figure, okay, when is the axe going to drop? He's going to say Hail Satan or something to that effect. Never happens. He's this kind of harmless old codger. And I just wish...
And they set up the possibility, at least in my mind, that he was in on it.
Because he's trying to bring this cult of devil worshippers back to the light, right? And so we think, I had this eureka moment where I thought, oh no, they converted him. That's kind of clever, actually. Like,
right.
He went amongst the wolves.
And he got swept up.
Yeah, right. It's this, like, diet off-brand, like, Colonel Kurtz kind of thing, where, like, he gazed too long into the abyss. And I'm a sucker for that shit.
Right. And not to mention that one of either Lorraine or Ed asks him, I think it's Lorraine, you know, why didn't you just burn all this crap, or just flat out says
That's
you
true.
Should have burned all of this stuff.
That's true. I forgot
and
about that.
He gives like a really unconvincing explanation for why he doesn't. He says something about like, I felt better about it. It made me feel like I was taking guns off the streets, you know. And it's like,
yeah, at least all these witches' totems aren't going to fall into the hands of those delinquent youths.
It's like that explanation would also apply to destroying everything.
Right.
So that's like a classic villain dodge.
Yes, it is. It is exactly that. He's still a likable enough screen presence that for some reason, for me, he didn't even register as a red herring. I mean, I'm shocked hearing the words come out of my mouth saying like, oh, they should have made him a villain. I would have been really impressed by that. Why? He's Denethor, for Christ's sake. But for whatever reason, I think it
all
really is.
All of the
just...
Denethor bile is drained out of him
in
this movie.
That chicken shit line just really caught me off guard, I guess. Very disarming. So, missed opportunity there. And then, in that scene, he has this out-of-nowhere line where he says, very meaningfully, camera tight on his face, something about how we have to be careful about our obsessions because they get passed on to our children. And he's like, looking at Lorraine when he says it. And I'm thinking, like, their child is not a key player in this movie. That's not a theme. What are you talking about? I mean, he's talking about himself, clearly, but the way the line is delivered, indeed, I think the way it's written, it's like that's the mic drop moment, and I just don't... Maybe in Annabelle Comes Home it might have been, because that's the one that's all about the Warren's kid, but not even, because in that movie, all the shit hits the fan because she's got a curious cat friend who lets all the monkeys out of their crate.
Well, and...
It's not her doing.
When the Warren's kid shows up in this movie briefly...
You had forgotten.
I had forgotten she existed. I was like, wait, they have a kid? I don't remember this. And
it shows you how.
In fairness to me, I think she was only in Annabelle Comes Home, which admittedly we did an episode about, so I should have remembered.
Shows you what a non-entity of a movie that was.
But it's not like, oh yeah, family of three from the beginning sort of thing.
Well, yeah, and if she was a memorable character that people were really clamoring to see more of, obviously she would have been given the Jimmy Olsen role in this movie.
Right.
Or a role more prominent than that, even. I don't know if it's the same actress. I couldn't even guess. But it's a serious step down for the character, at least. I hope there aren't any Warren daughter stans, because they're going to be sorely disappointed by this flick.
So I'm going to go ahead and recommend The Exorcism of Emily Rose, because that is the exorcism courtroom drama that we were halfway promised and then denied for this film. Follows the title character played by Jennifer Carpenter, probably best known either from being Michael C. Hall's sister in Dexter or being the lead in the American remake of Wreck named Quarantine.
Mm.
Plays this, I don't know, like high school or college girl who is possessed. And then I don't actually remember what the court case is supposed to be about.
I think she dies in the course of the exorcism, and then the father who performed the exorcism is on trial for murder or manslaughter dereliction of some kind of duty.
Well, yeah, right, like some kind of negligent homicide or something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it does all of the exorcism stuff. It features a lot of very physical actor work from Jennifer Carpenter. She does most of the contorting herself. Not a lot of CG there. I think there is a little bit of, you know, like spooky CGI stretch mouth from time to time, but it's mostly
classic Edvard Munch face.
Mostly practical stuff. But also, it's got, you know, good old-fashioned courtroom drama.
And good old-fashioned Tom Wilkinson, who we don't see enough of these days.
That's true.
He's the priest, isn't he?
Yes, I believe so. So, yeah, by all means, go check out Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's definitely a better use of your time than The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It.
And so is Bug, the William Friedkin film.
Okay.
Is it Ashley Judd?
Yeah.
And Michael Shannon. I am recommending it mainly because this movie, today's movie, gets a little bit interesting right before the murder, when the guy is totally spiraling, Arnie, I mean, and seeing shit and not in his right mind. And there's a feeling, you know, because you know that it's based on a real murder, obviously extremely loosely, to the point of it being pretty tactless and tacky. But nonetheless, for about 2 minutes, the movie builds a certain amount of momentum because you know that some watered down, schlocky version of a real murder is going to play out before your eyes. And so you think like, oh my God, what was going through the murderer's head in those moments when he was not all there? What did he see? What did he hear? Because he chalked it up to demonic possession. At least, you know, from a legal standpoint. But how did that feel? You know, these are interesting questions. Bug is a movie, very secular movie, that is about Michael Shannon, who's a very disturbed drifter, who kind of pulls this woman into the whirlpool of his insanity over the course of several days in a dingy motel room. He gets her all wrapped up in his paranoias and his weird convictions. He thinks that there's a government agency after him, and all of these different interlocking beliefs about shadowy cabals. It's like going through the looking glass and looking at one of these satanic conspiracies from the perspective of a skeptic. And it turns out that makes it more horrifying, not less, because you're watching two people in the throes of something that they believe in wholeheartedly, but which you, as an objective bystander, you just want to grab them like Arnie grabs the kid in the opening scene and make them snap out of it, but you can't. And in fact, after a certain point, you're mostly just grateful that you are not in physical proximity to either of them because you would be in danger. There's an unforgettable scene where Michael Shannon kills this guy, and Ashley Judd is freaking out, and he's like, he's not human, look! And he, like, gets some of his blood on his palm and his fingertip and starts lapping it up. And he's like, look, taste it! And you know, this is my best Michael Shannon impression. it's not real blood, it's synthetic. Look, taste it. It doesn't even say, it's not even close. So they're just lapping up blood like a pair of hounds, but convincing themselves that they haven't actually committed murder because it was just a robot, like a Terminator or something, who was sent to the hotel to dispatch Michael Shannon because he knows too much about X, Y, or Z sinister government plot. And the movie is just pure bedlam like that. It's really gripping, really disturbing. The acting is just off the wall. In the annals of Michael Shannon performances, it's got to be his most bug-eyed, best work as a, you know, as a badly deranged person, which he does so well. And I wanted more of that veneer of skepticism and objectivity from this movie. And I knew better than to expect it, obviously. But if I had gotten a pass at this script, I would have tried to bring some of that, even if I had the studio breathing down my neck. You know, the epilogue's got to be Sunday school, wholesome crap, and you've got the Warrens have to be right every single time. You still have to bring some, you gotta let the skeptic cop character get a word in edgewise, you know? Just
right.
Let him make the crack about Elvis and then cut away. Throw me a bone. Give me something. There's gotta be some room for doubt, because if not, you're just preaching to the choir. And if, like me, you haven't been converted, then it's like walking into a church service that's already in session and it's not your congregation and you just feel like you don't belong there. It's a kind of uncomfortable feeling, which might have been why I was pontificating at the top of the episode, wondering what was going through the minds of the people sitting around me, you know, in the dark, munching on their popcorn. Like, is this working for them? It's got to come down to just their beliefs. I mean, there's nothing else there. You either buy into it or you don't, I guess. But, you know, if it were William Friedkin directing this fucking movie, when they broke into the morgue, it would have been depicted as a break-in. You know, right. It would have been a really gross, unsavory kind of a scene. Or put it the other way, if fucking Michael Chavez or Gary Dauberman or one of these clowns had directed Bug, it would have actually been a robot that bled synthetic blood.
Yep.
And Michael Shannon would have been like, look, it's not even close. And she's like, boy, howdy, you're right. It's not even close. Phew. That's...
Thank God you didn't actually kill a person.
What a load off my mind.
Praise Jesus.
That morgue scene is just something else, you know, when they're monkeying around with the bodies. I just thought, like, and I try and not be this
what
kind
is this,
of
Bad Boys 2?
You're right, exactly. They do everything but admire one of the cadaver's knockers. I just thought, you know, I try not to be this brand of atheist. I try not to be like an IFL science guy. But when they were, you know, like holding the hand and establishing the connection, I just thought, adults work here. Go home. This is not your place. This is a house of science. Get this witch doctor voodoo bullshit out of here. I had like a reverse. I felt like a religious zealot in that moment. It'd be like
in that moment.
It was like no. It was like seeing a church being desecrated. I felt very strongly about it. And I did get in touch with my inner Jared Harris for a moment. Some of his, talk about people you don't want to interrupt when they're monologuing. God, the last episode of Chernobyl. Talk about shows that deserved to be four episodes exactly. Take note, Netflix.
Wait a minute, wasn't that five?
Four or five. Who's counting? Not me, clearly.
Exactly.
Four episodes exactly.
Or five.
I could have done with a sixth. Point is, no season two, none of that. I'm a movies guy. I like shows that are miniseries or canceled after one season so that they're a manageable size. And so in theory, these Netflix true crime docs that are four episodes and are probably never going to get renewed should still be digestible enough, but they're still too long in the tooth, too big for their britches. So I have a lot of grievances to air today. Needless to say, I'm getting out all my bile, much like John Noble. And I think I've exercised enough demons for one recording sesh. So he's Jim Smith.
And he's Matt Gerandasi. We're the Shock Doctors. We're not cursed. We're not possessed. Praise be to Jeebus.
Yeah, amen.
We'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, official trailer, uploaded by Warner Brothers Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, July 11th, and we will be discussing False Positive, which follows Ilana Glazer's run-in with a suspicious fertility doctor. See you then.